Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
Bernie Sanders says he'll fight for a more left-wing platform at the Democratic Convention. Donald Trump says Hillary Clinton only wins because of her woman card. John Boehner says Ted Cruz is Lucifer in the flesh, and Lucifer now has a running mate. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate. And our special guest is Robert Reich, professor of public policy at UC Berkeley and former Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. Welcome to all of you. So with Hillary Clinton winning 4 of 5 states on Little Mid-Atlantic Acela Super Tuesday, or whatever we're calling it, Bernie Sanders isn't dropping out, but he is signaling somewhat of a shift of focus with his campaign. He's talking about what he plans to do at a convention, even if he isn't going to be nominated at that convention. He wants to push for a strong progressive agenda, he says. That could mean adopting elements of his policy agenda into the party platform. It could also conceivably mean changing the rules that the party will use to nominate a president in future years. Dahlia, what do you make of this? If the idea is basically, I didn't win, but I came pretty close, and a lot of Democrats are with me on the issues, how does he translate that into moving the party leftward?
Well, I think he just feels like he has really mustered up an enormous amount of enthusiasm among young voters, that there are these issues that he doesn't want to let go of. He wants to push her on, you know, free tuition, on the minimum wage, on climate change, on trade, on Social Security. You know, these things he feels like if he keeps leaning on her, she will move. And I think he just has a very, very strong sense that that's his job right now. And I think he really feels as though, and he said as much. He has said, I'm not throwing my voters her way. She's going to have to earn them. So he's going to, I think, hold her feet to the fire and try to effect as much change in those areas that he still cares passionately about and thinks she does not care sufficiently about. He's going to keep pushing her.
Bob, where do you think specifically this is going to show up policy-wise? Because it looks to me like the sharpest area of disagreement between Clinton and Sanders in the primary campaign has been over health care, with Sanders pushing for single payer and Hillary saying that we shouldn't reopen the ACA debate. And that seems like an issue where it's hard to form a middle ground. Either you want to, you know, tear it up and start all over again, or you don't. Where do you think sort of pieces of the Sanders agenda can be picked up and plunked into a Hillary administration?
It's a good question, Josh. I don't think that there is going to be much movement if Hillary gets the nomination, Hillary Clinton, much movement to the so-called left. She has already moved considerably on the minimum wage, on the pipeline, the XL pipeline, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. She has shown a lot of flexibility. In fact, so much flexibility that there is a danger for her that a lot of Democrats may think, well, what does she stand for because she is so flexible? The Democratic platform is, as many people know, meaningless because unlike the old times, platforms can be adopted, but they have no sticking power. They have no significance. I think he really could and should press the Democrats for changes in accountability, in rules. That's what he really cares about. For example, the superdelegates. There's no reason in future presidential elections the Democrats should have so many superdelegates, while the Republicans don't. I mean, the Democrats become a less Democratic small D party. And the same thing with closed primaries. When you have so many independents, 42% of Americans now on polls say that they are independent, they are not registered with one party or the other. Closed parties become an anachronism. And I think that Bernie Sanders can push the party to make some commitments to change.
Rich, It seems to me like a parallel conversation is going to be had on both sides. Now, it's going to be a little different on the Republican side, because when the Republican establishment tries to figure out how to reincorporate Trump voters into its coalition, it will probably be after having nominated Donald Trump and lost. But when you look at this question going into 2020, sort of the same question Hillary's looking at now, how do we take this insurgent part of the party and bring it back into the fold? What are concrete answers on that? What are lessons to take from Donald Trump in terms of what Republican candidates should be calling for in 2020?
Well, that's looking very far ahead.
I'm already handing this election to the Democrats.
What's going to happen a month or two from now? Well, just a few points on Hillary. You know, one, Bob is right, of course, that the era of platforms mattering a great deal is long past. When Lincoln won the nomination in 1860, they basically said to him, don't say anything because we got a platform. It's unnecessary. Don't write anyone a letter about policy. Don't say a peep. And that day is long gone. And Sanders should be quite pleased about what he's been able to do, pushing Hillary to the left on trade, on Social Security, to some extent on the minimum wage. And these things aren't issues where she's going to snap back to the center in the general election, because she'd create an opening for Trump, because then Trump would pick up her position during the primaries on trade and hit her from the left on it. Same thing with Social Security. Trump doesn't want to reform entitlements. So this is it's going to be, if Trump's a nominee, a fascinating general election where for the first time in decades and decades and decades, basically the size of government is not going to be an issue in this race. And you know, as far as looking ahead, if Trump does lose in November, and he loses big, it's going to be enormously discrediting to everything he said. So you may have the Republican establishment lurching from their accommodationism, which is growing by the day, to Trump at the moment, to the day after the general election saying, oh, well, that's over. We can wash our hands of it and never think of Donald Trump or populism again, which I think would be a mistake. But obviously, there are a lot of ifs built into everything I just said.
Bob, on what Rich said there about certain Sanders issues from the primary being things that Trump could co-opt, I'm wondering, you know, as if Hillary's looking at the menu of sort of populist left things to run on, some of them look like they'd be assets in the general election and some look like liabilities. In particular, Sanders is the first really prominent Democratic candidate in a while to run on a platform that explicitly involves raising taxes on people with middle incomes in order to provide them a bigger government providing more services. And that seems like a really big internal policy question within the Democratic Party. If Clinton is someday goaded into taking that position, which she's been very resistant to so far, is that something that Democrats, that liberals can sell to the center, the idea that you should pay more for more government?
I don't think so, unless those increased taxes on the middle class are accompanied by some big benefits, like substantially lower health care costs. That's what the idea was and is behind the single payer plan. But anything else, I think it becomes very, very difficult. But Josh, I wanted to pick up on something Rich said, which is that the size of government is for the first time in living memory, not really a central issue in this election, assuming that Donald Trump becomes the Republican nominee and Hillary Clinton, the Democratic nominee. That's a big deal. I mean, it means that what we're really debating at the heart of this election is not so much the size of government, it's who government is for. This is the new divide between the anti-establishment and the establishment. And I think that we will discover, again, if Trump is the Republican nominee and Hillary is the Democratic nominee, that the old ideological debate we've been having in this country really does become something very new, very different, anti-establishment versus establishment. Trump will try to make Hillary even more of an establishment candidate than she already is. Hillary will try to focus on the aspects of Trump's anti-establishment position that are really least appetizing to the rest of America. But the currents of populist change are big.
Dahlia, what did you make of this stuff this week where Donald Trump repeatedly is hammered on this line that, you know, Hillary Clinton is playing the woman card and nobody would vote for her if she wasn't a woman. She'd get 5% of the vote. It seems like this wasn't just an off-the-cuff thing he said. He said it in multiple interviews. And John Boehner, who we'll talk about his Lucifer comments later, but in that same interview, he sort of mocked Hillary Clinton saying, I'm a woman, vote for me. It seems like this is a fairly broadly held sentiment among Republicans who are likely to be running against her.
Well, I think a couple of things, Josh. One is just that general vibe you get off Trump that anything to do with women, you know, their faces, the fact that they go to the bathroom during debates, anything is icky. And so there's just something icky about Hillary and the, you know, sort of presumption that she brings with her run. But I think in a strange way, I mean, I have to say, and one parses Trump at one's mental peril, but I've been trying to parse what the woman's card thing means. And I guess it means that she is a woman talking about women's issues. And if you try to flip that, you know, the alternative either is that she's not a woman, which makes no sense, or that only men are entitled to talk about women's issues, which makes no sense. And the whole thing is just so baffling because I guess it all comes under this umbrella of he's supposed to speak truth to power, right? He's fighting back against political correctness and, you know, power to the notion that he can just mash in her face, that her gender shouldn't count and that it's the only thing that matters. But it's really baffling because women, in fact, have the vote. They have jobs. They care about the pay gap. They care about family leave. And so it just seems like such a strange notion to me that he's saying that only men can appropriately talk about this, but probably better if it's not talked about at all, at a moment when women just represent the majority of the voters.
There was this moment back in the fall where Bernie Sanders was repeatedly referring to Hillary Clinton as an insider, and she said in a debate, you know, that basically that she couldn't be an insider because she's a woman, that there's nothing more outsidery than being the first woman president. And wasn't that kind of a card-playing thing? I certainly wouldn't say that that's why she's winning the primary or why she's going to be elected, but it does seem to me like she tried to use the fact that she's a woman as an out from any claims that is, you know, a former Secretary of State and former Senator and former First Lady and person with her name on a very prominent philanthropic foundation that just because she's a woman, she couldn't be an insider.
I think she's always going to have to thread that needle of saying, you know, I'm an insider and outsider. I'm qualified, eminently qualified, but I'm also a first. And I think she's trying much harder than she did, by the way, last time around to own the fact that she's a woman, to talk explicitly about women's issues. I don't think she's asking for a ton of extra privilege. I think what she's doing, and it seems to me not inconsistent with what any woman would do who's bumping up against a glass ceiling, is simply saying, wow, my experience is really different. It dovetails with the experience of other women, and I think we should talk about it. So I'm not sure that there's any falsity there.
Bob?
I don't think there's any falsity there at all. I think that Dahlia is absolutely right. The real problem for her here, and I think the Trump charges point this out, is that she cannot... At the same time, she's got to say, look, this could be historic. I could be the first woman president of the United States. Don't you want to make this a historic issue? But at the same time, when she does open herself up to the question, well, are you just qualified because you're a woman? And she obviously is not just qualified because she's a woman. As to Donald Trump, he is in the world. The Trump world is a world of put-downs and insults. I don't think he thinks for a moment that he is insulting all women. He is insulting individuals. That's his modus operandi. That got him into trouble. It continues to get him into trouble. And ironically, it also wins him a lot of votes.
Rich, do you worry about this? This seems like a considered strategy of Trump's. Is this something that makes you even more worried about him as the nominee?
Well, he's right about Hillary using the woman card. And at times, it's completely benign and to be expected, as when she points out she would be the first woman elected president. But at times she uses it to impute dark motives to anyone opposing her and to play the victim. I mean, she's done this repeatedly against Bernie Sanders, where will say something completely anodyne, like all the shouting in the world, you know, isn't going to solve the gun debate. And she's, what? You accuse me of shouting? It's because I'm a woman. Or he says, excuse me, during a debate. And all Hillary supporters say, well, look, this is Bernie mansplaining and being a sexist. So I think on a lot of this Trump stuff, and I've lived this, you know, for 9 months, it makes sense to assume there's kind of a shrewdness there that might not be evident to us at first blush. And I think he's kind of setting it up to anytime she goes to this, saying again, well, I told you, there she goes. She's playing the woman card. Now, the potential downside here to this gambit and to his style of politics generally, there's no doubt that it has succeeded in lighting up, you know, 40% of the Republican electorate, more in the Northeast. But at the same time, his numbers have gotten into toxic territory with everyone else. So with this kind of attack, the question is he attacking Hillary in a way that would work splendidly in a Republican primary, but that will seem tone deaf and bullying to swing voters?
Well, let us know what you think about the supposed woman card at kcrw.com/LRC on our Facebook page or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Ted Cruz's last stand. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Listen to KCRW's Music Stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. And you can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick of Slate. And Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton and author of the book Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few, is also with us. So Ted Cruz has had an eventful week. He announced Carly Fiorina as his running mate. He had a short-lived electoral pact with John Kasich that ended with both of them basically denying that there was any pact. And he got the endorsement of Indiana Governor Mike Pence, sort of. Pence said he's voting for Cruz, but he's, quote, not against anybody. He also praised Trump in his statement, and for good measure, he praised Kasich, too. Rich, what do you make of this Fiorina pick? Is this a desperate move? Is this a shrewd move? What's with this?
It's pretty desperate, obviously, and this is a campaign that may only have, you know, less than a week of viability left to it. So if you if you're down at the end of the game and you're at the 50-yard line, you throw the big long pass. And I do think she is a good surrogate for him, and they have a genuine bond, and he's been impressed by her. But everyone knew these would 2 weeks in the Northeast would be bad for Ted Cruz, but they have been worse than certainly I would have expected. I kind of wrote off Trump hitting 60 in New York to, okay, that's a home state advantage. But after last Tuesday, one, the establishment is obviously just sort of giving up the fight. Not that they were actively doing much to resist Trump all along, but it's really unhelpful to Cruz, kind of that mood music. Two, the math actually changed on the delegates because Trump was able to go out there and win 30 or 40 of these notionally unbound delegates in Pennsylvania. So that means he can get to 1237 while losing a place like Indiana.
For anyone who didn't follow this obsessively, Pennsylvania has this bizarre system where most of the delegates are elected directly by voters, just from a list, and there was some thought that Trump, with his organization, would not be able to effectively get the message out to voters about which delegates they should back. But in fact, a wide majority of the delegates that were elected through that system in Pennsylvania seem to be Trump delegates.
Correct. And the final thing is just, I think the Northeast is very telling about what might happen in California on June 7th if the race is still in play there, because it just shows how Trumpy blue states are with very weak Republican parties. Now, Cruz is still in this game. He's still in the hunt in Indiana. If he wins there, it will reset the narrative at least temporarily and open up the possibility of holding Trump, say, 50 delegates short of 1237. But Cruz is on a ledge, holding on by his fingertips at the moment.
The Indiana thing is funny to me in contrast to Wisconsin, which seemed to be the blueprint for the Republican establishment coalescing to stop Trump in a state where you had Scott Walker, who's the very popular governor, really going out there and pushing hard against Trump for Cruz. Whereas today you had this statement from Mike Pence that was just so weak and just seemed like he was put in a position where he like couldn't avoid endorsing, even though he desperately wanted to not take sides in this. It's like the opposite of the situation in Wisconsin, where you had the really strong coalescing of the establishment. Bob, I was interested when Ted Cruz introduced Carly Fiorina this week and explained why he endorsed her. One of the things he said was that she knows why jobs are leaving America. She seems like a really odd pick to me to sort of address the point that voters are concerned about job creation, given her record as an actual corporate leader.
utterly bizarre, because that record, remember, not only did she lose Hewlett-Packard a huge amount of money and they fired her because she was doing such a bad job, but she also laid off tens of thousands of Hewlett-Packard workers. I mean, she is one of the poster children for CEOs who take a lot of money and treat their workers pretty badly. An odd pick.
Dahlia, it's funny because it seems to me like the Republicans' theory of Fiorina is actually sort of a rehash of this gender card theory from when they talk about Hillary, which is basically the idea is that Fiorina can be especially effective in attacking both Trump and Clinton because she's a woman. In the case of Trump, because she will draw sexist attacks from Trump that will backfire on him, as seemed to happen back in the fall when he said she had an ugly face, basically. And then with Clinton, because she can be sharply critical without appearing to be sexist or without being criticized for being sexist. It's not clear to me this theory bears out, but I do think that's what animates Republicans and why they think she's an effective attack person.
I think that's right. And I think that it's such a sort of one inch deep analysis, because if you look at Fiorina and you say, OK, well, you know, she's a woman, therefore she'll be able to attack Hillary without looking, toxic the way Trump did. It's such an interesting problem because, of course, you know, Fiorina has been really, really quite complicated in her relationship to women. You know, she's blamed women for the pay gap. She's Planned Parenthood's sting video and her insistence that she saw that which no other human eyes have ever seen. I mean, she's really not a terrific proxy in terms of talking to women. And I think that's probably the case across ideology. So I think the theory is that as long as she is a woman, she serves certain purposes without too much scrutiny of what she has said about women and done for women, which is much more fraught.
There's also the very odd Republican, or maybe it's just Ted Cruz, conceit that if somebody is not from Washington, if they haven't served for many, many years in the Senate or the House, they're an outsider. They're anti-establishment. But Fiorina, not only has she run for office, but she, being a CEO and having done what she did as a CEO, is the very, she's the establishment. She is, of course, the establishment.
Rich, also this week we had John Boehner speaking at Stanford, giving some colorful quotes that I think led to the first significant scoop from the Stanford Daily student paper affecting U.S. politics this year, including saying that Ted Cruz was Lucifer in the flesh and that he had never worked with a more miserable son of a bitch in his life. And I think most importantly, saying that he could support Donald Trump as the Republican nominee, but he could never support Ted Cruz, something that former New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg, a moderate Republican, also said this week. Why do these people personally hate Ted Cruz so much? It really seems to go beyond dislike. These people, it feels like they would enjoy watching Ted Cruz die.
Yeah, hatred is an entirely apt word. And with Boehner, I don't think Boehner has had much personal involvement with Ted Cruz whatsoever.
It's well, Ted Cruz was his lawyer in a court case. In 1998.
There you go. Yeah. And Ted Cruz basically had de facto control over these 30 or 40 House members in the House Freedom Caucus, the right of the caucus that forced Boehner into the shutdown confrontation and basically ended up deposing him. And clearly, John Boehner holds a grudge. And Ted Cruz's theory of how you become the Republican presidential nominee turns out to have been correct. You go into Washington, you step on a lot of toes, you brand yourself as the anti-establishment guy, and if it weren't for Donald Trump, you know, a big if, I believe Ted Cruz would probably have the nomination locked up by now, because the voters who aren't just dissatisfied with Washington but angry at it, you know, they're go with Trump now. They would be with Cruz in the absence of Trump. The voters who want an outsider, you know, Cruz has managed to brand himself as an outsider, although looking at his CV, you would sort of be surprised by that. But he's run into this phenomenon of Trump, who has outsidered him, and Cruz ends up being in this fight where at least some support from the establishment, or at least it's not its evident hostility, would help, and it's just not there for him. And I just don't get saying that you can vote for Donald Trump but not vote for Ted Cruz, just entirely based on personal dislike. That just seems incredibly short-sighted and petty.
Does anyone want to stick up for what's basically Donald Trump's talking point on this, which is that it's a mark against Ted Cruz that everybody he works with seems to hate him? Donald Trump has this weird combination in this election where he's, you know, he's the anger candidate and he's talking about how everybody's stupid and whatever. But at the same time, he talks about how he can make deals with anyone and he tries to find common ground. And he goes out there and says to a Republican electorate that has generally enjoyed people who fight against Washington insiders that it is a mark against Ted Cruz that he cannot work with these people, that they hate him so much. Isn't that
there's a real paradox here, because Donald Trump, in a relatively short time on the political scene, has managed to alienate almost every ethnic group, women, racial minorities. I mean, he has, just through his carelessness and his put-downs and his bigotry and his bloviations, has really done more to alienate most Americans from the Republican Party than any other single person. Now, Ted Cruz, I've been in and around politics for 35 years. I have never, ever encountered a senator who is as detested by his colleagues of the same party. The Senate is the kind of place where they pride themselves on working a little bit together, at least in the same party. And you just mention Ted Cruz to any Republican senator, and they will either make a face or say something far worse than John Boehner said.
Maybe the gloss on what Bob just said is that I think Donald Trump probably takes a certain amount of pride in the fact that the people who hate him just don't know him yet. And once they get to know him, they're going to love him. Whereas with Ted Cruz, the people who know him really hate him. And that doesn't get fixed. And it's just a strange, it really is a paradox that Donald Trump keeps insisting that everyone who's ever met him comes around in the end. And nobody ever comes around on Ted.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
We learned the last week or so that life expectancy for white women in this country declined year over year from 2013 to 2014, and suicide rates are at the highest level they've been in 30 years. All of this is another sign of an ongoing working class cataclysm in this country that demands the nation's attention.
Dahlia Lithwick.
I sat through the Supreme Court arguments this week. It looks clear that they are poised to exonerate former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell on his public corruption charges. It seems that the idea that he took tons of money and gifts and free vacations in exchange for doing favors for wealthy donors is completely fine, because after Citizens United, we can't stop defining corruption down. The court seems to think that if everybody does it, it must be okay. And it really feels like Citizens United coming home to roost in a very concrete way.
Robert Reich.
I don't think either party understands what they're up against in terms of what Sanders and Trump represent. A huge force in this election of anti-establishment populism on the right, authoritarian populism on the left, progressive populism. But it's a rant. It's an anger emerging from a middle class that's shrinking and less secure economically against what they see as a game rigged against them.
For my rant, one of the big mysteries of this campaign has been why John Kasich is so happy. He told a reporter this week he's having the time of his life. He really seemed to mean it, even though he's losing really badly and stands basically no chance of becoming president. I think what it is that he believes he will be proved right in the long run. Either Ted Cruz or Donald Trump will be an electoral disaster, and people will look back and say, gee, I wish we'd nominated him. Plus, he gets to eat all this great food across the country along the way. You know, here in California, they put French fries inside the burrito in San Diego. It's called a California burrito. And if John Kasich knows that, there's no way he's pulling out before the California primary on June 7th. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Dahlia Lithwick, and Robert Reich. Laura Dine-Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Ashleen Knutson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.